You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts on Spotify or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. For those of you I've not had the honor of meeting, my name is John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution. And it's a great pleasure this afternoon to welcome you on behalf of everyone at Brookings for what promises to be, I think, a wonderful discussion with the former British ambassador to the United States, Sir Peter Westmacott. He's going to explore the ideas that he has put forward in his book, They Call It Diplomacy. Ambassador Westmacott's book chronicles his 40-year career serving his country in several positions around the world, and with a career spanning from the Cold War to the post-9/11 era. Ambassador Westmacott served in many important roles, including as Britain's ambassador to Turkey, ambassador to France, and most recently, ambassador to the United States. Prior to his ambassadorial stints, he spent 4 years as a diplomat in Iran, and he led, which led his tour there, led the 1979 revolution. But the book draws heavily from these rich experiences to consider the art of diplomacy and its vast importance to global diplomacy and ultimately our outcomes. It must also be said that Ambassador Westmacott was appointed a companion in the Order of St. Michael and St. George in the year 2000 before being raised to the level of Knight Commander in 2003 and then Grand Cross Knight in 2016 for his exemplary service in diplomacy. Now Ambassador Westmacott's book comes at a critical time as the Biden administration establishes its foreign policy priorities and re-engages with the world. Ambassador Westmacott's book reminds us of the importance and the importance of diplomats and the importance of diplomacy that it will play as we continue to re-engage with communities around the world and to further American foreign policy, and in particular, with friends like the United Kingdom. So with that in mind, today's conversation will focus on the broader Middle East region at a time of heightened tensions with Iran, just as the United States has made the decision to pull out of Afghanistan, which is now an inflection point for many of us. Questions about the ongoing U.S. commitment to this vital region have grown, and the Biden administration has focused much of its foreign policy attention on other areas while these questions continue to linger. However, it's clear that we have an enduring interest in this region to help to reduce conflict and instability and to set it more on a stable direction for the future. And to achieve this aim, we need to strengthen our relations and our collaboration within the region and with global partners. And of course, Ambassador Westmacott is certainly able to tell us about how we should be thinking in those terms. And of course, as this administration has said, it's going to rely a great deal more on diplomacy and less on the military instrument of power. So ladies and gentlemen, let us begin. And Ambassador Westmacott will be joined by our Vice President and Director of the Brookings Foreign Policy Program, Suzanne Maloney, and Senior Fellow and Director of the Brookings Intelligence Project, Bruce Rydell. And briefly, I remind everyone that we're very much on the record. We're streaming live, and questions can be sent to us at events@brookings.edu or on Twitter using hashtag Middle East. And Suzanne, before I turn it over to you, I just wanted to remind the Ambassador that the last time we saw each other was in the White House. He was coming out of the Oval Office with a friend of his Royal Highness Prince Harry, and he steered him over to see me as I was headed into the Oval Office and reminded the prince that he had been an Apache pilot for me in Afghanistan. And we had a wonderful conversation about our shared tour in Afghanistan. So, Peter, Ambassador Westmacott, it is an honor to be with you today and to have you with us at the Brookings Institution. Thank you for joining us. Suzanne, over to you.
Thanks so much, John, for that wonderful introduction. I'm really pleased to be here today to host a conversation with Ambassador Westmacott, whose new book, They Call It Diplomacy, is just a wonderful tour de force and tour of the horizon of his own diplomatic service and really a wonderful overview of how diplomacy plays a role in shaping the world around us. And so we're looking forward to that conversation. I urge you all to read the book, particularly if you're interested in the region that we'll focus on today, the Middle East, where Ambassador Westmacott has had a very long experience. Ambassador Westmacott and I are joined today by my colleague, Bruce Riedel, who is, as John noted, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, both in the Center for Middle East Policy and our Center for Security Strategy and Technology. Bruce, too, has a long experience in government on his part with the U.S. government. He retired in 2006 after 30 years of service at the Central Intelligence Agency, including many postings overseas. He served as senior advisor on South Asia and the Middle East to four presidents and on the staff of the National Security Council at the White House, as well as a deputy assistant secretary for defense for the Near East and South Asia, and senior advisor to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization in Brussels. We're really thrilled to have these two gentlemen here today to talk about the region, about both past and future, and where policy and particularly where diplomats can play a role in addressing some of the challenges that we're facing today. So I'd like to start where both of you began in many respects in terms of your own careers, and that is an issue that is near and dear to my own heart, the issue of Iran. Both of you had early experiences in and with Iran in terms of your own career. Ambassador Westmacott, you write in the book about your posting in Tehran between 1973 and 1978, as well as future and onward engagements with the issue of Iran. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what Iran was like back in the early 70s and what you saw really on the cusp of this historic moment that led to the Iranian Revolution in 1979.
Suzanne, thank you. And may I just begin by saying a word of appreciation to General John Allen, whom I first met in Helmand in Afghanistan, oddly enough, and we've been good friends ever since then. It's a privilege to be with you and with Bruce on this panel, intimidating in some ways, but thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to have this conversation. So, Suzanne, to try to go back a little bit to your question back then, I went to Iran as a very young diplomat. My first overseas tour, I'd spent a little time learning Persian at the School of Oriental and African Studies in London before I went there. I sat cross-legged on the floor with some carpet bazaar people in Shiraz trying to put into practice what I'd learned in the schoolroom. And my job really was to try to understand what was going on in Iran. And from Iran, I had the opportunity to go and do a little tourism, do you believe, driving my old Land Rover across the desert into Afghanistan through Herat and Kandahar and Bamiyan and so on. Back in those days, mid to late 1970s, that was something that you could do. Now, Iran at that stage was a country which everybody was rushing to because many Western economies, not least the British one, were in the doldrums. We had high interest rates, high unemployment, very low growth, lots of problems, trade deficits. And Iran, after the Shah had tripled the price of crude oil on Christmas Eve 1973, was suddenly the land of El Dorado, and investment bankers and arms salesmen and all sorts of people turned up, good people and bad people, looking to do business there. So it was a very exciting place to be. It was a country where an awful lot of different nationalities, races, ethnicities, religions felt very welcome. It was an inclusive, dynamic, dramatic country, proud of a civilization going back thousands of years, and I would say not at all intolerant. And so it was an extraordinary place to be and a great privilege to begin my diplomatic career there. But of course, you know, you live in a country like that for a little while and you begin to realize that there are certain flaws, weaknesses, and you wonder where that's going to lead. To be honest, I think very few foreign diplomats, even as late as 1977, early 78, believed that by the very beginning of 1979, the Shah would have left and Ayatollah Khomeini would have come in and a theocracy would be instituted. And a relatively tolerant society was replaced by a very intolerant theocracy, which is still there with some changes in charge of a much more damaged economy than they inherited 40 odd years later. So I would say that at the time, did I see what was going to happen? Not really. Did I write the odd report as a cub diplomat saying, you know what, I think there are some things that are going wrong here, and which if you joined the dots, and if this and if that, might mean that the peacock throne, as we call it, is a bit less stable than we would all hope? Yes, I did. But it was pretty tentative. It was certainly not, how could it be, a definitive prediction. If any of us had known what was coming, it wouldn't have come like it did. And we wouldn't have all have been caught out. And I think there wouldn't have been now the same amount of difficulty in the political relationships that there are now. One of the reasons why the United States, United Kingdom are able to work together in many respects about Iran is that in those 40 years, you haven't had a single diplomat on the ground in Iran, which I think is a tragedy, but it's an indication of the geopolitical reality. Whereas most of that time, the Brits have had an ambassador and an embassy. Not always. We've had a few bumps in the road, but we've been around and we've been able to try and make some sort of head or tail of what's going on there and play a role in trying to address some of the very complex diplomatic and other issues which we've all had to try to address with the Iranian government.
Ambassador Westmuth, that you're being a bit too humble. I noted from your book that you not only were one of those who did see some of the signs of the revolution, you talk about a report that you wrote after a visit to Tabriz in early 1978, but you also noted in your book that you were the one of the best students of the renowned Persian professor at SOAS, where I also studied Persian, Anne Lampton, who characterized you in later in her life as one of her best students. And clearly your language capabilities served you very well in terms of your posting there. This is one of the issues that has come up quite frequently in some of the after action reports about American diplomacy in Iran in the 1970s. There were, of course, Persian speakers there, including John Limbert, who has written quite a bit about Iran since and his own experience as one of those seized at the U.S. Embassy in 1979. But for the most part, American diplomats were hampered in their ability to engage with Iranian society and particularly with those groups that were beginning to become politically engaged around what later became the revolution. And so there were many signs, at least in Washington, that were missed in terms of understanding where this was leading, the dissatisfaction that was mounting with Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi at the time. Bruce, I want to turn to you now and bring you in on this point, because, of course, you were also at an early point in your career in the late 1970s, and you happened to have been assigned, if I recall, to the Iran desk just before the revolution. And I wondered if you might say a few words about the perspective from Washington at that time and how we understood what was happening and how we might look back on what worked and what didn't work in terms of how we're able to anticipate developments around the world today.
Certainly. I arrived at the CIA in 1977, fresh from Harvard. And I was assigned the Syria desk. And I was on the Syria desk through the Camp David summit. And shortly after the Camp David summit, I was reassigned to the Iran desk, because by October of 1978, it was abundantly apparent that things in Iran were not going the way we had hoped they were going. The previous team was moved to other accounts, and a new small team was set up. One of the things that struck me from the beginning was that we didn't understand the Shah very well. The United States had believed its own propaganda, that the Shah was this firm, decisive man who was taking his country from medieval times to be the Sweden of the Middle East. In practice, the Shah was a particularly indecisive man, who at the moment of truth in 1953, when the agency and MI6 were putting him back in power, fled the country to Baghdad and on to Rome. And his indecision played a critical part in 1978. I'm not going to question whether or not the Iranian army could have quelled the revolution. I think that's probably unlikely. But at least a decision to do one thing or another would have been much more effective. But we had come to believe our propaganda about him. And I think that hurt us tremendously. Of course, the other thing was we'd spent no time in our years in Iran engaging with the mullahs, the Ayatollahs. Now, that wouldn't have been easy. They were not exactly pro-American, and Ayatollah Khomeini was already firmly anti-American. But we had very little knowledge in those days. I was very fortunate that at Harvard, I had taken a course in modern Iranian political philosophy. And I knew who Ali Shariati was. I knew who Ayatollah Khomeini was. Because I was studying early Islamic history, I could read their speeches and make sense out of them. Not everybody knew the story of Kerbala and the Battle of Qadisiyah and all these kinds of things. What is striking to me in retrospect about my whole period in government dealing with Iran is that while Americans often see Iran as the source of all evil and tend to characterize the Iranian leadership as almost demonic terms, most American presidents, one or two exceptions, have sought to restore relations with Iran. That was the case with Jimmy Carter after the revolution, which is why he got part of the reason why the hostages were taken. That was certainly the truth with Ronald Reagan. No matter what you may think of sending a Bible and a cake to Iran, it was an attempt to engage with the Iranians. It may have been the most ridiculous attempt ever, but it was an attempt. Certainly George H.W. Bush attempted to, and the president that I worked for the longest, Bill Clinton, spent his second term in office literally chasing Khatami around, trying to find a way to shake his hand. It became almost embarrassing in some cases. And of course, Barack Obama is the one who succeeded in establishing a face-to-face relationship with the Iranians. And I'm sure Joe Biden is going to try to restore that again. I think it'll be difficult. I think the hardest part is going to be here in Washington, because rejoining the JCPOA is going to be opposed by all the Republicans and a significant number of Democrats. So Joe Biden's got his work cut out for him on this.
Thanks, Bruce. And I'm glad you've brought us back up to the contemporary period, because Ambassador Westmacott writes about his own role in some of the diplomacy and the politics here in Washington around the JCPOA, which, of course, is now high on the agenda for the Biden administration. But I'd like to focus for a few moments about that period of time and your own role, Ambassador Westmacott, during the run-up to the decision and the vote in Congress around the JCPOA. This was a highly politicized and highly polarized debate here in Washington. But you were, along with other senior diplomats from some of the other partner countries to the JCPOA, deeply involved with helping to make the case on behalf of the diplomacy, on behalf of an agreement that could promise to curtail some of Iran's nuclear progress, at least for a period of time. Can you reflect on that period, your role, and particularly whether or not the JCPOA might have succeeded had it not been scuttled by the Trump administration?
Yeah, happy to try and do that, Suzanne. May I just have a couple of words on the very interesting points that Bruce was making? I don't want to rewrite history. I would make a couple of comments. One is 1953, where the British and the Americans combined to get rid of the elected Prime Minister Mossadegh. I think it was a moment when it confirmed a lot of the conspiracy theories that a lot of people in that country had about the malevolence of our two countries and our two governments, which was probably relevant 25 years later. Not directly, but I think indirectly. But the Shah was not part of that operation. You know, he left the country actually because the coup initially in the first few days was a botched job, and there wasn't really anywhere else for him to go. So I think we shouldn't be too harsh on him about that, although I don't dispute about the indecision point. Second point I would make is that fast forward to the time of the revolution, and I think Bruce's judgment is correct. And I'm afraid what had happened was that, as so often happens with somebody who is in a a fairly authoritarian position for too long, they become less and less interested in hearing anyone or anything other than applause. And so there weren't very many people still alive and still around to give the Shah unwelcome advice as to what was going wrong and how to handle the difficulties which then led to his overthrow. And one of the last problems that they made, even a year before the revolution, was when the government started blaming Ayatollah Khomeini, who was in exile in Kabbalah at the time, for dissent amongst university students in a way which I think was tactically pretty unwise. And a number of other errors of judgment were made at that stage. But it was complicated, and I think it is correct to look back to the history of the early 1950s in trying to make sense of what's gone on since then. But to your question, Suzanne, I think what was unusual was that we had a number of foreign ambassadors, and I very much enjoyed working closely with my Chinese and Russian, as well as my French and German and EU colleagues on Capitol Hill, who were making the case to US lawmakers for an important element of US foreign policy. Now, normally you might say that would be foreign interference. And indeed, I was accused of being a foreign interferer, foreign meddler in American domestic politics by one or two people who didn't like the JCPOA. But we were, of course, co-signatories, co-negotiators, even if the leading role had been taken by the United States initially in secret and then subsequently in the group of the P5 plus one, as we called ourselves. So there was a certain legitimacy, I think, because the rest of us had signed the agreement and we wanted to see it go through. And we didn't want to see this flagship element of the Obama administration's diplomacy go down in flames. And I remember John Kerry saying, you know, with this deal, we have avoided a war. And it sure felt at the time as if this was a very significant agreement. So the role that we were playing was to make the case that even though it did not do a number of the things that were not written on the tin, in other words, you know, it was never intended to constrain Iran's behavior in the region, much of which was frankly pretty unacceptable. But that wasn't what we set out to do because it wasn't realistic. What we set out to do was to take advantage of the fact that international sanctions had reached a high point of their effectiveness. They had never stopped Iran enriching uranium. We tried before, but we'd failed. But it had brought Iran to the stage where it was ready to negotiate a deal because we were all there together. And to take advantage of that, to see if we could find an agreement which would prevent Iran getting nuclear weapons. Now, what happened is what happened. And we succeeded, I think, in ensuring that there wasn't ever actually a debate on the floor of the Senate, which would be significant, which would require the president to exercise his veto. He didn't even get to that point because I think there was a degree of effective international diplomacy. But your other question was, you know, where did that lead us? And might we have made something of it, made more of it in the next couple of years had President Trump not walked away from that deal? And I think the answer is a little complicated. One of the problems was that even before we had any of this business of whether or not the agreement would be torn up from the United States point of view, there were unilateral, if you like, United States sanctions applied to Iran, which were not suspended, whereas the international sanctions of the United Nations and the European Union had been suspended. And the Iranians believed that in exchange for full compliance with the quite intrusive inspection regimes and other requirements of the deal, that there would be economic relief. And one of the early problems, long before President Trump came on the scene, if you like, was that despite the best efforts of Secretary Kerry and others, there was a great reluctance amongst international businesses and banks and others to do business with Iran, running the risk that they would fall foul of US sanctions because the dollar is the world's most important economy. And anything you do with dollars affects your ability to trade in the United States or to work in dollars, if you're a bank, for example, anywhere else in the world. And so people were very, very nervous about that. So it got off to a very slow start, and then the Europeans started trying to put together different schemes that would give Iran some of the relief to which it was entitled. But it was not doing very well in terms of giving the Iranians what they were entitled to do. And there were certain people who were saying that Iran was not following the letter of the agreement. I would argue that on the whole they were, until such time in May 2018, as President Trump said, I'm ditching this agreement. And then the Iranians, after a pause to see whether the Europeans could bring the United States back to compliance with the deal, then they themselves began to move off the railway lines, if you like, move beyond the constraints, literal constraints of the agreement, and then it all began to fall apart. And now we are at a rather important moment when diplomats in Vienna and elsewhere are looking very actively, I think, as far as I can tell, with genuine political will from both Tehran and the United States, it almost goes without saying with the other members of P5+1, at putting Humpty Dumpty back together again and seeing whether we can reestablish this framework so that there isn't going to be continuing enrichment and so on inside Iran. And I think if the deal can be put back together again, then a stage two, if you like, there could be further negotiations on other issues that quite rightly concern many people in the United States on Capitol Hill and further afield. But there are 150 odd members of the House of Representatives who have signed a letter, who have asked the Biden administration to give high priority to try to make this deal come back together again. And I think that's a significant message to the administration. And I personally am very pleased that they are making a very big effort to restore the agreement to the statute book, if you like.
You raise, I think, a number of important points there. One is the sort of difficulties that the JCPOA was facing even before the Trump administration came into office. And you write in the book in particular about the dangers of weaponizing the U.S. dollar and the kind of double-edged sword that presents. It clearly, you know, we were able to have an enormous impact on the Iranian economy, even with the unilateral sanctions, the unilateral measures of the Trump administration, and no cooperation from the rest of the world, fundamentally because, as you say, companies, entities, individual investors around the world are going to be governed by their need to access the U.S. marketplace and, of course, to have access to the U.S. dollar. And so, I think one of the elements that we are still grappling with is to what extent this period of time when the Trump administration did use those sanctions with a lot of dissatisfaction and very little support around the world, how will that impact the future of the dollar as a global currency? And that is one of the threats that you wrote about in the book. But I do want to bring Bruce into this conversation about where we go from here on the JCPOA. The Biden administration came into office with a number of senior officials testifying to the desire to find a pathway toward a longer and stronger deal. And there has been, I think, something of a debate within the administration and certainly a debate within Washington, one that has once again involved many members of Congress. As Ambassador Westmacott has said, there are dueling letters, some suggesting we should not go back, some suggesting that we should absolutely go back to the JCPOA. And it really comes down to, I think, a divergence in opinion. There are many who believe that to get anything with Iran, we just have to get back to what worked the first time. And that was the JCPOA. It was the first agreement that the United States and Iran have been able to sign on to since the Algiers Accord that freed the hostages and returned some of Iran's assets after that hostage crisis in early 1981. And so it was the first really successful piece of bilateral diplomacy between the United States and Americans, even if it was done very much in a multilateral context. And so to build on that, you know, you have to get back to that platform. There are, of course, many others, and I want to give some hearing to this view, who argue that the JCPOA, in a sense, has a natural obsolescence. Some of the sunset clauses, the restrictions in the deal begin to expire even within the Biden administration's first term in office. And the Iranians, by walking back their own commitments under the deal after the Trump administration walked away from the deal, have now benefited from enhanced access to advanced technology, advanced centrifuges, that they have, in effect, given themselves, poised themselves to be able to shorten the breakout period as these sunset clauses begin to expire. And so we shouldn't go back to the deal. The logic then goes, we should really take this opportunity, use the leverage, is the phrase you hear most often, that was amassed by the Trump administration to try to bring the Iranians into a tougher deal to begin with. And of course, you know, the foremost advocates of this point of view argue that what we should be doing is going for the deal that many Republicans supported at the outset, which is a deal with no enrichment on Iranian soil. And so, you know, it appears, at least from the public coverage, and who knows how accurate any of this is, that what the Biden administration is now doing is really going for the JCPOA as the starting point, and then, you know, other things can happen thereafter. But I just wonder, one, which of these views you favor, you know, going for longer and stronger or going for the JCPOA as the starting point, but also how you think Congress is going to react. And I'll start with Bruce, but I'd love to come back to Ambassador Westmacott, particularly on the congressional dimension, because you were so involved with some of the debates back in 2015.
Well, directly to your question, Suzanne, I think the right approach is to go for going back to the deal. Secure the first step first. That will be hard enough. I would also like to make a broader point here. The U.S.-Iran relationship has always involved a third party, and that party is Israel. And Israel will be a major player in how the Congress reacts on this. It's interesting to note that Israel's posture has changed significantly over time. It was, after all, the Israelis who convinced the Reagan administration that arms for hostages was the right way to move and that you could actually make a deal with the Iranians back in the 1980s. Shimon Peres is the father of many things, including the Israeli nuclear program. He was also the father of the American outreach to the Iranians in the Reagan years. Current Israeli Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu, has been the most outspoken opponent of the JCPOA from the beginning. He even took the extraordinary step, you will remember, of addressing the Congress without asking the president's approval against it. And that raises an interesting question to me. If Bibi Netanyahu is not going to be Prime Minister of Israel, as I think there is increasingly likely, might the Israeli posture towards the agreement shift somewhat? Might a new Israeli government, I don't know, be a little bit more interested in seeing if the agreement can be revived? We'll have to wait and see. But certainly if you don't have Israel as the leading opponent of the deal internationally, it may be easier to get Congress and American politicians and the American public to go along with a renewal of the deal. I'm very skeptical of the idea of a bigger and better deal. Yes, we should extend the timeline. That's a good idea. But the thing that most people want to do for a bigger deal is include the Iranian missile program in the negotiations. I understand the logic of that, but the Iranian missile program is essential to their self-defense. And for their ability to project power in the region, and particularly to project power against the Israelis, which is why they've given Hezbollah so many of these missiles and rockets. I just don't see a deal there. I don't see why the Iranians would give up missiles. They need something very, very significant in return from us, and I don't know what that is. So I will leave it there.
Suzanne, would you like me to comment as well?
Please, I'd welcome your thoughts on this.
I mean, my sense is—I'm sorry to disappoint you—but it's quite similar. I think trying to get a bigger, more restrictive deal, more restrictive in terms of the constraints on Iranian behavior, first off, is not realistic. The reality is that on the Iranian side, there are quite a lot of people, and we need to remember that there are many different power bases and many different voices in Tehran. There are quite a lot of people who feel that because the United States broke its word and walked away, then it's the United States who should be putting more bread on the table, if you like, rather than asking for Iran to give up more in exchange for getting the deal put back together. And you know, that's a pretty powerful message amongst Iranian people, like every government, which is in some difficulty and has got a weakened economy for all sorts of different reasons, then you do you look to the cause of nationalism and national pride as part of your diplomacy, but also part of your appeal to public opinion. And that is a message which I think goes down pretty well with an awful lot of Iranians who feel that the United States has not treated them fairly on this. Even if it was a different president, the one who is now there, it's still for them the United States. So I agree that I think the right way is to try to put together something resembling the deal that there was and not to try and load it up with additional issues. I think those should be left to a separate negotiation a little bit later on. We've got Iranian presidential elections, remember, coming up very soon, and we don't know what's going to happen there, as well as the very important issue that Bruce Rydell mentions of, you know, where will Israel be? The reality is that when I was on Capitol Hill arguing to give diplomacy a chance, we had, you know, daily calls to almost every United States senator coming from Prime Minister Netanyahu saying, this is a terrible deal, you absolutely must kill it off. If Israel is no longer going to be that concerned, that's perhaps the wrong way of putting it, but if you like, not going to be strongly against an agreement, then I think that can change a lot of things. Now, on ballistic missiles, I also actually agree with Bruce Rydell. I recall that, you know, during the Iran-Iraq war, where the Iranians not wrongly believed that Western countries were very supportive of Saddam Hussein and provided him with a lot of material and indeed some intelligence and encouraged him to have a go to destroy the theocratic revolution. You know, we had crewed missiles landing in the British embassy territory in Tehran, launched from Iraqi territory. Iran had no defense against hostile missile attacks. So for them, a degree of ballistic missile defense, and I think we can put constraints on their capability and their range, but I think ballistic missiles are part of their, if you like, fundamental national defense, which is a very important part for them. It would help enormously if they stopped painting Marad Bar Israel on some of those missiles, death to Israel, which just makes it even harder politically for others to go along with a diplomatic agreement or an attempted new agreement, which does not include ballistic missiles. But in the real world, I think it does not make any sense to try to put together something resembling JCPOA and put that in the hopper as well. It's not going to fly. So let's be more realistic. And my understanding, though I'm nothing to do with government anymore, is that in Vienna, you know, the discussions are closer to the sort of realism, if you like, that we've just been trying to sketch out.
I do want to go beyond.
Can't hear you.
Book, Ambassador Westmacott, but I want to just take this opportunity to throw one more issue that's Iran-centric into the conversation, and that is separate from the nuclear issue, the question of detainees, both dual national and those who are foreign nationals held by Iran on trumped up unjust charges, primarily as leverage or bait for both the UK and the United States. This has been a persistent issue since 1979. Do you see any hope that we're going to be able to help bring about the release of Nazanin Ratcliffe, of Siamak and Bekar Namazi from the United States side, Morad Tapaz and Imad Shaki, a number of others who are currently held, and this is obviously an issue of tremendous concern for both governments.
You're right. It is an issue of tremendous concern, and those people are being detained for no good reason, and it sure looks as though they are political hostages. I think there are, I know it's a top priority for both governments to make progress on this. What is linked and what is not linked, I cannot judge. There is an issue for the United Kingdom of an outstanding payment of £400 million, which we have long since agreed is something that we owe to the Iranian government. But that is something which is caught up actually in this issue of financial sanctions against Iran and what channels can be used. But I think it would make an enormous difference to the prospects for putting together the diplomacy, something like the JCPOA, if those issues of real humanitarian concern could be resolved. And as you say, United States and United Kingdom are concerned, partly because there are people who are both US and UK, as well as Iranian nationals who are caught up in this terrible situation. And I think progress on those detainees would help to create a much, much better atmosphere. So I'm very much hoping that the high priority which both governments are giving to making progress on those consular cases does bear fruit sooner rather than later.
I'd like to turn now to Afghanistan. This is almost mirroring your book. You talk about toward the end of your tour in Iran, taking a road trip to Afghanistan, Ambassador Westmacott, and obviously, in many respects, both countries have been, on something more than a road trip in Afghanistan now for nearly two decades. The announcement on the part of the Biden administration that the United States would, in fact, withdraw all troops from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year is probably the most consequential decision, and to some extent, at least among the Washington establishment, somewhat controversial decisions on foreign policy that the new administration has taken. It appears to have wide popularity with the American public, but at least at first, it wasn't entirely clear that there was sufficient consultation with some of our partners on the ground in Afghanistan and our allies over this approach. So I wondered if both of you could speak to both the politics of the decision to withdraw and what this may mean for the future of Afghanistan and the wider region.
Who do you want to go first, Suzanne?
Bruce, why don't we start with you here?
Okay. I was not surprised that Biden did this. When I did the review of Afghanistan-Pakistan policy, using the phrase AFPAC, at the beginning of the Obama administration, Joe Biden made it very clear he thought the mission in Afghanistan should be shut down, or at least removed to a very, very small level. And I think his position has become stronger, harder over time. My own view, and I agonized over this a long time after Biden made his announcement, is that he's probably done the right thing. And I say that for these reasons. As he notes, the reason we went to war in Afghanistan, we've accomplished. Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan and Pakistan is a hollow shell of what it was back in 2001 and back in 2009. The SEAL raid that brought justice to Osama bin Laden really broke the back of the Al-Qaeda group. I'll give you one small example. Last September, bin Laden's successor, Ayman Zawahiri, issued the annual Al-Qaeda message lauding the attack of 9/11. Not a single major newspaper in the entire world covered that news. It just didn't seem relevant. I also think that Biden is right that the war against the Taliban is not one that is ultimately winnable. And it's not ultimately winnable because as long as the Taliban have the support of Pakistan, particularly sanctuaries and safe havens, but a lot more than that, you cannot win that war. So I think he has reluctantly come to the conclusion that it's time to come home and to see if the Afghans can survive on their own. And here I will take a risk and make a prediction. I think the Afghan government will lose some provincial capitals, probably in the south. But I think the Afghan government will hold on to Kabul, and a significant part of the country will rally with the Afghan government against the Taliban. There are a lot of Afghans who do not want to go back to living under the Taliban rule. Many of them are young. And I think these people will stand together as long as they get the kind of international financial support they need. They will be able to hold on. Perhaps that will lead in time to a negotiated political solution to the war. I think that's a long way off, but I think it is.
Ambassador Westmacott, you dealt with the issue of Afghanistan through multiple points in your own diplomatic career while you were ambassador to Turkey. And of course, you visited Afghanistan while our president, John Allen, who was on the call earlier, was the commander out there And so I wonder if you could reflect both on your perspective, helping to mobilize the diplomatic coalition around Afghanistan, the diplomatic and military coalition, about what's been achieved and what's at risk with this decision to withdraw.
I think 20 years on, it's not a bit surprising that a president who was pretty firmly opposed to earlier forms of surge in Iraq and Afghanistan and to military action in Syria and Libya, but not in Iraq, should have concluded that this was the time for the United States to leave. It's true that Al-Qaeda is not what it was 20 years ago, thank God. What worries me about it is that the political basis, if you like, for leaving, the political agreements that exist to help determine the future of Afghanistan are between the Taliban and the United States. They are not between the Taliban and the government of Afghanistan. And those negotiations are continuing. We really need them to succeed if there is to be a life in Afghanistan for those who do not wish to live under a tyranny of Taliban. There are people who say, but the Taliban are not what they were. Look, you see girls going to school and you don't see women treated as badly as they were when the Taliban were in power 20 years ago and providing safe haven to Al-Qaeda. That is true at the moment, but that is because the Taliban do not control the whole of the country. They control large swathes of it, but not all of it. I would be delighted if it became possible for there to be a political settlement between Taliban, the government of Afghanistan, and if some of those benefits which have been achieved in recent years are maintained. I worry that it might not be, and that, so I think a top priority must be given during the remaining months that we're all in Afghanistan to try to facilitate a political settlement that preserves those advantages. And I think that what has been worrying is that while the Taliban have held off attacking foreign military troops who are in Afghanistan following the Zalmay Khalilzad agreement, what they have not held off doing is assassinating any independent lawyer, journalist, female political, social leader who they think just might dare to stand up to their view of what sort of society Afghanistan should be. There's a daily basis in which people are slaughtered simply for that reason, while they clear away those people who might stand up to them. That I find deeply worrying. And that's why it is very, very important that we try to do all we can together to strengthen the Afghan government and to ensure there is a viable political future and not simply handing it over to the Taliban in such a way that it goes back to where Afghan society was 20 years ago, which is not an appropriate legacy to leave to the poor people of Afghanistan who've been on the receiving end of so much of this.
One of the, I think, important elements of this withdrawal, of course, is that American and British diplomacy will remain. And one of the great arguments here in Washington about the quote-unquote forever wars is the need to reprioritize and reinvest in diplomacy rather than simply utilize American military presence as a means of influence, particularly in the Middle East, where we have had such a significant presence over the course of the past 20 years. And so I'd be interested in this broader dimension of the extent to which since 9/11, Americans have conceptualized our role in the Middle East in very military terms, but ultimately, there's the opportunity for a kind of diplomatic surge, and where we are able to have influence, it is not always, in fact, perhaps not primarily through our military presence, but in fact, our ability to help shape outcomes on the ground. And that's precisely where diplomats and diplomacy leads. And this is, of course, the subject of your book in many ways, the theme throughout your book in many ways, Ambassador Westmacott. And I wonder if you could just speak to, how both Britain and the United States can take advantage of this moment. I think whether it was John or you might have called it an inflection point, really, for American presence in the Middle East. The British, of course, experienced this in a prior era in terms of their own military withdrawal from the region. What is the role and what is the possibility for diplomacy at this point in time? And how do we really capitalize on that? And that can be in Afghanistan in particular or more broadly around the region.
Well, it's a really tough question, Suzanne. I think implicit perhaps in your question is a sense that the response to some of these really significant geopolitical crises has been a bit over-military and a bit under-diplomatic. And you can sustain that argument if you look at what's happened in Syria, you look at what's happened in Libya, where I think there was a degree of mission creep after the Europeans and the United States went in militarily to Libya in order to save a humanitarian disaster in one city and stayed on till there was regime change, if you like. And then if you look at Iraq, which I think is a much, much harder military campaign to justify than the coalition of 35 countries which went into Afghanistan just 2 years earlier. I think that that was a very military response on the basis of what turned out to be misleading, to put it kindly, intelligence. So, and an awful lot of damage has flowed from a number of those decisions. That said, I think, I hope that if we go back to Afghanistan for a moment, that there will remain what we used to call in the jargon, hull down a military presence. That is to say, you may be gone, but there remains a capability to come back for specific purposes if it will make a difference to help solve this or that particular problem. So diplomacy that is not backed up by a credible use of force in certain theaters, I'm not saying this by any means everywhere, is sometimes diplomacy that can be toothless. So I think you've got to have a series of different elements that are part of your package. There is diplomacy. There may not be much call for conventional warfare of the sort that we've been used to for so long. There are an awful lot of things you can do much more cheaply and much more effectively. Look at Iran's homemade drones. Look at Turkey's homemade drones. Look how effective they can be, sometimes causing, fortunately, minimal human casualty, but making a very powerful message, for example, by striking at oil production facilities in Saudi Arabia. So, and look at the impact of sanctions. I'm not a huge supporter of sanctions unless they are linked to a specific aim which you are trying to achieve as a result of those sanctions. Otherwise, it's a very blunt instrument which tends to have an impact on the economic well-being of the people least to blame for the transgressions of their government, which I think has been one of the problems in Iran. I mean, nobody's going to pretend that the government of Iran is wildly popular, but it is the people of that country who tend to pay the price for the mistakes that they make. So I think there are several different arrows that we need to have in our quiver, perhaps less emphasis on conventional military might, perhaps more creative use of the different elements that we've got at our disposal, including certain elements of cyber warfare, as well as the low-cost drones and other things that we can do to make a difference. But fundamentally, I would welcome, of course I would say this, wouldn't I, seeking to resolve problems diplomatically where we can. But that is not always possible. And sometimes that diplomacy is the more effective if there is a less pleasant alternative, which is there in the background if diplomacy fails.
Bruce, would you like to come in on this topic?
Certainly. The United States now has roughly 60,000 soldiers, airmen, sailors in this theater of operations at any one time. If you look at it in historical terms, this is not the norm. Up until 1990, the United States had a very small military footprint. Basically, the bases in Bahrain and Turkey. We sold a lot of arms to the US, as have the British, but we didn't maintain troops in the region. Now, that changed in part with the Iran-Iraq war. The United States went to an undeclared naval war with Iran. But what it really changed was in 1990 with the Iraqi invasion of Kuwait and American buildup. And then, of course, 9/11 produced an even bigger buildup. I completely agree with the ambassador that the decision to attack Iraq in 2003 has to be regarded as one of the most foolish decisions any American president has taken. I think we can downsize more. I think Afghanistan should not be the place where we're the only place. We don't really need to have American conventional military forces in Saudi Arabia these days. It's very interesting to me. One of the things that is changing very rapidly in the region is the Saudi attitude towards Iran. We've seen a stunning reversal in the last couple of months, including a secret talks with the Iranians in Iraq, and then the Crown Prince coming out and saying that the goal of Saudi Arabia is to have a friendly relationship with Iran. Anyone who's followed Saudi policy for the last 6 years, this is almost fell over when I heard him saying these things. That's not the position we've been in before. I think there are a lot of reasons for that. I think this is a place where American diplomacy should encourage these conversations. It's in our interest to have Iran, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia talking to each other instead of firing missiles at each other. And I think this is a real opportunity for Joe Biden and his team, and I hope they will grab onto it. This could be a significant shift towards reducing sectarian tensions and possibly to resolving the war in Yemen, and perhaps other places as well.
We have just under 20 minutes left in our conversation, and I'm going to turn very shortly to questions that we're receiving from the audience. Just a reminder, you can send those questions in through the Q&A function or send them to events at edu or on Twitter using the hashtag Middle East. But before we turn to some of those audience questions, I want to bring up an issue and a player that we haven't yet mentioned in depth and which does feature in some of the queries that we're getting from the audience and certainly was a major part of your own diplomatic career, Ambassador Westmacott, and that is the country of Turkey. You served two tours there, just as you served two tours in the United States. You were there during tumultuous periods for the country and for the relationship with Britain and more widely with Europe. And you were there for some of the formative early years of Erdogan's rise to power. And so I wonder if you could reflect on where you see Turkey today, where you think there are opportunities for engagement, and whether there can be a constructive relationship between Turkey, Europe and the United States in a way that can contribute to both resolving security challenges in the region, but also toward advancing a better outcome for democracy in the region.
Thank you, Suzanne. I think Turkey has changed a lot in the 20 odd years, more than 20, actually 25 years since I first went there. But the early years of the AKP government, which is still the government that has got the majority of the seats in the parliament there, I think were a period of considerable reform, encouragement, modernization. Many of the countries, including NATO allies, which want the best for Turkey, were delighted to see that. Turkey had had a series of ineffectual coalitions, military interventions, not usually, if you like, getting rid of democracy. It was usually because left and right came to blows in the streets and the military stepped in, the military being a very, in those days, respected institution. And they usually put civilians or invited civilians to resume control again pretty quickly afterwards. But nevertheless, the military were the dominant player in public life and took their responsibility to promote and protect secularism as well as the national entity very seriously. I think all this came together quite effectively as Turkey began to say to itself, let's see if we can join the European Union. In the early years of this century, there was economic stability, there was a lot of investment, there was progress with employment, there was a more enlightened approach towards the Kurds, which had been a long-standing difficulty. 15 million of the population, maybe 20 million now, the population of 85 million of Turkey is Kurdish, living in the southeast, And it's long been a very difficult relationship. That minority was not treated well for a long time after the creation of the Republic of Turkey in 1923. But Prime Minister Erdogan began to take a very different approach to all that, to the speaking of the Kurdish language, to broadcasting and newspapers and so on in Kurdish. The death penalty was abolished. Torture began to vanish. A lot of good things were happening in Turkey. And I think Turkey's friends in the European Union, the Council of Europe, in NATO, in the United Nations were pleased and encouraged by what they saw happening. Turkey played a significant role as part of ISAF in Afghanistan, subject we were discussing just a moment ago, quite a leadership role, which General John Allen will recall. And so it was a serious player on the international stage, and it was pleasure to be there and to be part of it. But a lot of things then began to go wrong after 7-8 years. The two main groups which had brought the AKP to power, which was a sort of Islamist nationalist party, both the party and then the what's called the Fethullah Gulen movement, which is an Islamist grouping, a bit like in some ways like Freemasons, if you like, with the head of it, an exiled preacher, self-exiled preacher, Fethullah Gulen, who lives in Pennsylvania. You know, he had been and his network had been instrumental in bringing the AK Party to power, and then they began to fall out. And then we had a number of trumped-up charges, trials on the basis of zero evidence, generals and others, civilians, journalists put in prison, and a lot of the achievements of those early years began to fall apart. And with it, the economy began to falter. And with it also, partly because of a failure to resolve the territorial dispute on the island of Cyprus, Turkey's accession negotiations with the European Union began to get stuck as well. So lots of things began to go wrong. And I think it's probably also fair to say that, you know, with Prime Minister Erdogan, President Erdogan, as he now is, increasingly the dominant figure, and other political parties, some of them, if you like, prevented from having normal airtime, less freedom of expression, less freedom of the press, less rule of law, less independent judiciary than there had been in the early years. All this has led to a more dominant political figure at the heart of the system, who I fear is a little bit more interested, as I was saying earlier, people who stay in power for too long, in hearing applause than in hearing unwelcome truths about what is the best way to promote your own legacy and indeed the future of your own country. So I think we are at a difficult moment. I am very fond of Turkey. I wish the best for it. And I go back regularly. And it would be, I think, wonderful to see that country continue to advance and make the best of its opportunities. At the moment, it doesn't feel like it's doing that. And the relationship with the United States, which, as you rightly pointed out, was of critical importance, has got a whole series of things that are going wrong on both sides. There are grievances on the Turkish side, and there are grievances on the United States side. You know, Turkey's buying S-400 missile systems from and installing from Russia, which is not at all helpful to the technological integrity of the alliance. There is a bank trial going on in the United States, which the Turkish government does not like the look of. There was a pastor who was imprisoned for no good reason, which it was very difficult for the Trump administration to secure the release of, but they did. And there are issues to do with sanctions and money laundering and the decision of the United States government when it was trying to support opponents of President Assad in Syria to go with highly trained and highly capable and very professional Kurdish militias, which were very closely aligned with a terrorist organization inside Turkey called the PKK, which, of course, deeply upset the government of Turkey. So those are just some examples of the difficulties that are out there and which need resolving. I can recall not very months ago having to say to Turkish friends who were convinced that President Biden hated Turkey, I said, you know, I happen to know the incoming president. Nothing could be further from the truth. He is a man who is under no doubt whatever about the importance of Turkey and wishes the best for it. But he may have said one or two things about the direction of travel of the Turkish government. But that's not the same thing to say that he doesn't like the country. I think the reverse is the case. I'd hope that's true. I believe it to be. And so I think there's plenty of scope to try to restore balance to that relationship and to try to deal with some of the outstanding issues. The United Kingdom is closely engaged with Turkey. Curiously enough, we've just left the European Union and Turkey wanted to join, but isn't probably going to, not for the foreseeable future. So we are two now growing economies on the fringe of the European Union who may find that there are things that we can do together in a way which is supportive of many of the objectives and values that the European Union and NATO hold dear. That remains to be seen, but it's a potential opportunity for Britain to make its presence felt once again in foreign policy and diplomacy, which for the last 5 years, because we've been wrestling with how to make a sense of Brexit, I feel we've been a little bit off the pitch, and now we are back. So it's a long answer to your question. I think it's of enormous importance, Turkey, and an enormous importance to get the relationship of Turkey's allies with it sorted. But there's a good deal of work that still has to be done.
Bruce, would you like to come in on the question of Turkey?
Certainly, anyone who follows this region can see that Turkey is crucially important to virtually every other issue, whether it's Iran, Iraq, Syria, Cyprus. We need to maintain this relationship. A NATO without Turkey would be a much different kind of organization, much weaker. I am puzzled in this regard at the Biden administration's decision to recognize Armenian genocide. I don't really see how that helps. It doesn't help Armenia. It certainly doesn't resolve the controversy over this. It seems to me to be a gratuitous error part of the Biden administration. And I have to strongly suspect it has a lot more to do with domestic American politics than it has to do with the situation in the region. It's done now, and it cannot be undone. We'll see the impact of this decision in the future, and I don't think it's going to be good.
I'm going to turn now to several questions that we have. We have quite a number of questions from the audience, and I unfortunately won't be able to get to all of them. I'm going to take the liberty of merging several together. We have a number of questions from the audience who are interested in your views, Ambassador Westmacott, about the present state of diplomacy and the future of diplomacy. Several of them, including from Alan Peck, a professor, who asks about the impact and damage done on the morale and the capacity of U.S. diplomacy by the prior administration. Similar question from Nancy Springer, a contractor at DOD, who asked much of the same. But I also noted a question from someone at the State Department who was interested in your views about how we can improve diplomacy. What are the skill sets that diplomats need to have to adapt and work in, as we're now doing in a virtual era, much more technological era than the kind of traditional interpretation of how diplomats function. So I wonder if you might say a few words about, how a diplomatic apparatus might rebound after a period of turmoil within the United States' place in the world, but also about, what diplomacy means in an era in which cables are outpaced by tweets.
Thank you. Well, on the first point, I certainly, even though I have not been an ambassador for 5 years now, I certainly noticed that within the U.S. Foreign Service, there was a good deal of pain amongst professional diplomats because much of what they believed in, much of what they'd worked for, was being undermined by, government by Twitter and some of those early morning messages, which didn't even seem to reflect the considered view of the administration, and sometimes left members of that administration itself scrabbling to make sense of them. You know, there were some pretty gratuitous attacks on NATO, which is important to many of America's allies and friends. There was some hostility towards the European Union. There was some very anti-German remarks, which I never fully understood. There were remarks which were supposedly helpful to Prime Minister Theresa May on Brexit, which President Trump said he was a supportive of, but in fact made her life more difficult by some of the things that he would say in interviews that he would give to Murdoch newspapers. So there were difficult moments, and I know some colleagues of mine who resigned or were driven out by some of the political appointees with whom they could not work. And I thought that was very sad to witness. Of course, we've always known that the United States system has a much larger proportion of political appointees than most other, if you like, modern, sophisticated institutional foreign services. But I think I recall Secretary Blinken saying that he intended to reduce the number of ambassadors under this administration who were going to be outside appointments rather than professional diplomats, foreign service officers. I think that will be very good for morale. It'll help encourage really good people to continue to want to make a career in the US Foreign Service, which, regardless of what I've just been saying, remains one of the finest in the world. And certainly when I was traveling around the world in the different jobs that I had in London, I always made a point of going to see the United States ambassador if he had time to see me, because I knew I was going to learn something about that country, especially if I didn't know much about it beforehand. And because it was always a pleasure to talk to somebody who not only spoke the same language literally, but also you pretty much understood where we were coming from, the Brits and the Americans together in terms of values and strategic priorities. And that was a great joy for me as a professional diplomat. So I think this can bounce back. And I think that America's allies are very pleased by the messages of support for international institutions, for multilateralism rather than unilateralism, for working with allies. I suspect there's still a bit of work that needs to be done about what I might call early stage consultation in Washington, even with the like-minded. This is not a comment about any particular decision, but I've seen Washington at work for a number of years. And I see that even when there are decisions that directly relate to the interests of many close allies, you know, the NSC machinery whirs and the deputies and the principals make their pitches and decisions are taken and the president or the vice president determines what the policy will be. And then someone picks up the phone to close allies and says, here's what we're doing, guys. Are you with us tomorrow night, kind of thing? And I think a little earlier consultation, where possible, would help have greater buy-in, if you like, from allies, and would help make the United States even more effective as the leader of the free world, if I can put it like that, in terms of consensual diplomacy, where you want the maximum possible number of people working with you to deliver the results that we're trying to achieve, as we tried to do in Afghanistan. John Allen did that after he had left the armed forces and did that as the coordinator of the international coalition against ISIS or Daesh, as we called it. So I think lots still to play for, and I see already many, many signs of things getting better after what had happened beforehand. Your second question, I think that we are obviously in a very different world from when diplomatic dispatches were put in a diplomatic bag, carried by a human being in a piece of canvas on a scheduled airliner. And that was the means of communication from an embassy back to head office once a week or once a fortnight if you were in a more remote part of the world, apart from the occasional cable. Now it's instantaneous. And of course, the media will expect immediate responses when something happens at different parts of the world. There isn't nearly as much time to stop and think and consider what is the appropriate response, or indeed to consult allies. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. But we do live in a different world because of the communications anyway, in some ways facilitated by the virtual world that COVID has made us operate in, because it means that you can actually organize a consultation with allies even more quickly. And sometimes more efficiently than you used to, when it meant getting on an aeroplane and trying to clear somebody's diary. You get a remarkably high turnout sometimes now, especially when it's an important subject, when you need to do that. Now, that is communication between policymakers in capitals. sort of underlying your question was, is there still a role for diplomats as well? And I would say that the expertise and the knowledge of the local situation, the local people, the trust that hopefully they have built up, and the tactical advice that they can give their own head offices on how to get the right outcome. What is the real bottom line of the other party? What can you aspire to achieve, and what is completely unrealistic? All that still requires local knowledge and local expertise. So, of course, I would say this, wouldn't I? But you know, I do think that there is still a need for professionals who get under the skin of the place where they are assigned and can make the effort to understand the culture and, if possible, the language, and build the relationships of trust so that they are spoken to, they are consulted, they are part of the local fabric, and can offer the best quality professional advice to the decision makers back in capitals.
Well, that is a wonderful place on which to end, but I'm going to take the liberty of throwing one more quick question in there from Lynn Stover, a retired Peace Corps volunteer, who I think links this final topic of the value of diplomacy with where we started, the question of Iran. And she asks whether the Biden administration ought to try to reestablish a U.S. embassy in Tehran if we're in fact able to generate some diplomatic traction around either a return to the JCPOA or some kind of arrangement around the nuclear issue. And so in our final moments, I wondered if either of you would like to speak to that question.
Bruce, you go first.
It's been a long time since we had a presence in Iran, and our understanding of Iran has suffered grievously by that. You can study a country all you will from a distance. Now, you need to walk on the streets of it to really understand how it works. And we now have generations of American diplomats. At the same time, though, I would say putting an embassy in Tehran also play big in Iranian domestic politics. And I don't think it plays big in the right direction for us in Iranian domestic politics. We should start small, an interest section that is actually manned by Americans, maybe, but a formal American embassy. I think that's going to just bring out hardline elements who will say that whoever authorized the recreation of an American embassy is a spy of the CIA and working against Iran's national interests. While I definitely think it would be very useful to have one, I can also see that the politics of it within Iran might be such that this is not the first thing. You know, in addition to violating the JCPOA, Trump had also eliminated the meetings between Secretary of State Kerry and his Iranian counterpart. We weren't in a perfect place in 2016, but we did have an ongoing dialogue between the Secretary of State of the United States and his Iranian counterpart. Now, they didn't always agree. They did talk to each other. And if you look at the history of American Iran since 1978, that was a remarkable achievement. And the Trump administration just let that go by even before they got rid of the JCPOA. That's where I think we need to get back. Senior level dialogue between Tehran and Washington. An embassy can come later, but get the dialogue going on a daily basis first.
I would add very briefly, Suzanne, if I may, I think that Iran is the second most advanced technological country in the region after Israel, despite all the sanctions and everything else. It is an entrepreneurial society. I think there are more people in Iran who would love to get a green card and go and make millions of dollars in California than there are people who want to go on jihad. Jihad, by the way, was never something which the Shia Iranians involved with. You know, who were the people who flew the airplanes on 9/11? They came from Saudi Arabia, most of them, and they came from one or two other countries. None of them were Iranians. Tehran was the street where there were spontaneous candle-lit processions in mourning, despite everything, for the victims of 9/11. So there's a very interesting potential relationship between the people of Iran and the United States of America. You've got to start slowly. You know, you had an intersection with lots of American diplomats in Cuba for a long time. When I first went to Iran, the largest diplomatic mission in that city, after the United States one, was the Israeli one. It wasn't even an embassy. It was an Israeli intersection. They were there, but it wasn't called an embassy because the relationship back in the day between Israel and the Shah's Iran was so important and so intense. I think it would be a wonderful outcome if we could get there eventually, but it's not going to happen overnight, and it'll be politically complex for a number of different reasons. And my last little comment on diplomacy is just to say, back to where we were on Afghanistan, while we look at trying to ensure that the gains of recent years in Afghanistan are not lost as the Taliban, begin to make their pitch, let's not forget about the importance of talking to Pakistan next door, without whom the Taliban are not able to control the country to the extent that they do at the moment. The Taliban were largely created by Pakistan, and we must ensure that they are part of that discussion and part of the debate about what happens to the people of Afghanistan in the years to come.
Thank you so much, Ambassador Westmacott. Thank you, Bruce Riedel. This has been an incredibly rich discussion. And while I would love to continue, there's so much there to unpack and to continue to engage around. I'm afraid our time is now done. So with my deep thanks and looking forward to hearing you both again and to seeing you both again in person, They Call It Diplomacy by Ambassador Peter Westmacott. This has been a discussion by Brookings Foreign Policy, and I thank you all and look forward to seeing you all again soon.